Hello and welcome to SSI Live. You've long known the Strategic Studies Institute, or SSI, at the U.S. Army War College as the go-to location for issues related to national security and military strategy with an emphasis on geostrategic analysis. SSI conducts strategic research and analysis to support the U.S. Army War College curricula, assist and inform Army, DoD, and U.S. government leadership, and serve as a bridge to the wider strategic community. Now we're bringing you access to SSI analyses, scholars, and guests through this, the SSI Live podcast series. Thanks for joining us.
Hello and welcome to this edition of SSI Live. My name is John Denny and I'm a research professor of national security studies here at SSI. It's Tuesday, December 12th, 2023, and today I've invited Bob Hamilton, research professor of Eurasian Studies at SSI, to talk to me about relations between China and Russia, specifically about how those relations manifest themselves in Africa. Bob recently authored an article for the Foreign Policy Research Institute, or FPRI, entitled "The Dragon and the Bear in Africa: Stress Testing Chinese-Russian Relations." His study examines whether and to what degree China and Russia are collaborating or competing in Africa. So I've asked Bob to discuss the study and his findings with us and to shed light perhaps on what the relationship in Africa between these two strategic competitors might mean for the U.S. So Dr. Bob Hamilton, welcome.
Thanks, John. It's good to be with you.
All right, Bob, let me begin by asking you to spell out for us or explain to us what kind of framework of analysis did you use first when you were looking at China and Russia in Africa?
Sure. So the framework is one that'll be very familiar to a lot of folks who work or have worked in the U.S. government. It's a version of the DIME, diplomatic, informational, military, and economic instruments of power, instruments of statecraft. Although for this report, I actually dropped out the I. Information becomes so hard to operationalize and quantify, at least in a report of this length, that I really just focused on diplomatic, military, and economic presence and interaction of China and Russia in Africa.
All right, well, let's walk through each of those areas now one by one. Let's start with the diplomatic. What did you find on the continent of Africa in terms of diplomatic relations undertaken by Russia and China in terms of cooperation or competition? What did you see?
So first of all, I would say they're unequal or unbalanced. China has a much larger diplomatic presence on the continent of Africa than Russia does. China operates embassies in all 54 countries. In fact, they have a larger presence in Africa than we do, and a larger global presence. China surpassed the U.S. a few years ago to have the most diplomatic missions in the world. But in Africa, they have embassies or missions in all 54 countries. Russia has embassies or missions in 39. So there's an inequality in their sort of diplomatic weight on the continent of Africa. The other thing I found is that both of them use their lack of a colonial past in Africa to leverage diplomatic support from among African countries. And African countries at 54 votes in the UN General Assembly make up the largest regional voting bloc in the UN. So China and Russia are able to sort of cooperate diplomatically to use their lack of a colonial past, remind African countries that many Western partners, Western states do have a colonial past, or in the case of the United States, is assumed to have colonial pretensions or quasi-colonial pretensions in Africa. China and Russia use this informationally to leverage diplomatic support among the African countries. And you see that especially in UN voting records, where African countries tend to be very supportive of the One China policy, very supportive of China's territorial integrity, China's sensitivity toward any perception that external states or institutions are interfering with its prerogatives in Xinjiang, and also African voting records on Russia's invasion of Ukraine, whereas Africa is the part of the world where there are the largest numbers of abstentions or no votes in terms of UN General Assembly resolutions to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Bob, that representation of China across the continent of Africa, is that a relatively recent phenomenon? Is that something that, is of the Xi Jinping era, or does it precede his leadership in China?
That's a good question. I think it's certainly accelerated under Xi Jinping, who's been in power since, if I'm right, I think since 2012. So It certainly accelerated under him, but Africa really, China really began to expand its diplomatic presence in the earlier part of the 21st century. But as I said, it's a larger presence now than Russia is in Africa.
Okay, let me ask you now to turn to the military realm. What did you see there in terms of the competition or collaboration between the two?
Yeah, so interesting. I didn't see a lot of collaboration, but certainly no competition. Interestingly, in Africa, China actually has a larger conventional military presence. It has a base, an acknowledged base in Djibouti. And consistent rumors or persistent rumors that it's going to open another base on China, on Africa's west coast in Equatorial Guinea. Russia doesn't have an acknowledged base in Africa, but it has a much larger presence if you include the Wagner Group and Redoute and Convoy and all these Russian private military contractors. In terms of military presence, Russia's footprint is larger, but it's largely unconventional because it's PMCs, and it's largely unacknowledged. In other words, China acknowledges its base in Djibouti. It calls it a logistics hub. Russia doesn't really formally acknowledge its Wagner and other PMC presence in Africa, even though the numbers are significant. The numbers I keep reading are 30 to 50,000 people on the continent that serve Russia's security interests in some way.
All right, and finally, Bob, let me ask you about the economic dimension of this. How did you see that playing out in Africa?
Yeah, there's really no comparison between Chinese and Russian presence, economic presence in Africa. China's is very broad-based. It's comprehensive. It's instituted through two initiatives, the Belt and Road Initiative, which everyone knows about, which largely does infrastructure development, and the Global Development Initiative, which is newer than the BRI. But whereas BRI does sort of World Bank type infrastructure development, GDI, Global Development Initiative, does capacity building, economic capacity building. And it's very prevalent in Africa, very much part of China's strategy in Africa. One thing I found that maybe a lot of your American listeners will be surprised by, and some will probably be maybe upset by, is very little support for our debt trap diplomacy narrative. Very little support at all. In fact, I've researched this extensively. I've talked to not only people in Africa, I did field research in Ethiopia, Kenya, and South Africa, but experts like our own Zanel Garcia here at the War College who study this for a living. And there just is no support for this narrative that China issues predatory loans, and then when the countries can't pay, China seizes the infrastructure. Certainly, that's never happened in Africa. And when you talk to Africans, including policymakers and scholars, the general sense you get is that the BRI is win-win in Africa. Now, I just finished a chapter of this book on Central Asia. The perception there is completely different. There's a whole lot of skepticism of the BRI in Central Asia. Among regional states, and there's a whole lot of anti-Chinese sentiment in Central Asia that just doesn't exist in Africa.
But what about the role that Chinese laborers play in some of these projects that China is funding through the BRI? Is that generating any kind of negative repercussions or pushback from African states toward China's efforts?
Not in Africa, no. And again, I'm going to apologize because I'm just finished the Central Asia chapter of this same book project. Central Asia is on my mind as well. It very much exists there. In fact, Central Asian countries have passed laws, many of them requiring that 70 to 80% of the workforce in BRI projects consists of locals. In Africa, there's not a lot of that skepticism or idea that the Chinese are sending workers in and taking jobs from Africans. In fact, the only person I had in Africa that really had anything significant to say about this at all was a guy who told me, well, look, this was in Ethiopia. He said, most of the workers are locals, but the workers will go home at 5 o'clock and the Chinese managers and engineers will stay late and operate the construction machinery. And in that way, they're actually a good example for us. So, you know, there's just a very different perception of the BRI, at least from what I found in Africa, than there is in many other parts of the world.
All right, Bob. Now, so you've outlined for us what you found in terms of the diplomatic, the military, and the economic relationship. Can you summarize that for us? Where do you see, like, what does the stress testing reveal to you overall about China versus Russia in Africa?
Yeah, so I use sort of a four levels of interaction. I classified it as either cooperative, complementary, compartmented, or competitive. And what I found in Africa is that, you know, cooperative behavior is when China and Russia sort of formally and overtly coordinate their activities to be mutually reinforcing or mutually supporting. And what where I found them doing that in Africa is cooperation in reducing Western influence or the Western footprint. They have that very much in common as a goal in Africa, although for Russia, it's more important than for China. I mean, Russia will sometimes subvert other goals and subvert China's economic goals in order to sort of degrade Western influence, try to chase out Western peacekeepers or UN peacekeepers. Those are goals that China doesn't necessarily share, but they do share the overall goal of reducing Western influence in Africa. The other thing I found that I thought was sort of interesting is they both share an interest in cultivating South Africa as sort of their agent, a principal agent for their interests in Africa. And that doesn't mean South Africa has its own agency, right? And it's sometimes I had a couple of South Africans tell me, we very instrumentally sometimes use this to our own benefit. And we can play one off of the other. And so many people in South Africa are aware that at least in sub-Saharan Africa, that country is the preferred agent for both Russia and China in representing their interests. And they do appear to cooperate there. There doesn't really appear to be a whole lot of jealousy of between Russia and China in South Africa. You know, I mean, one of the big things that happened this year was a trilateral Russian, Chinese, South African military exercise that occurred. Actually, it was going on the first anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So the South Africans took a lot of heat for that. But nevertheless, that is one area where they also seem to cooperate. So degrading Western influence and promoting South Africa was somewhere where I found a lot of cooperation. In terms of complementary activities, I didn't really see a lot. What I did see a lot of is what I would call compartmentalization, where each is sort of doing its own thing and stays out of the way of the other. But is sort of generally aware of what the other is doing, but just doesn't interfere, doesn't support, but also doesn't try to undermine. And you see that in Africa. You see China very focused on diplomatic and economic engagement, and Russia very focused on military or security engagement, especially through PMCs like the Wagner Group. And then geographically, you see China is very focused on the Gulf of Guinea and the Horn of Africa, because those are two they're energy rich and export places where port infrastructure, pipeline infrastructure, and all those things are important to Chinese trade aspirations, and also places that have been beset by instability and piracy and things like that. So China very focused on outside of South Africa, those two regions. Russia is more focused on North Africa and the Sahel, the former due to sort of longstanding arms sales relationships with places like Algeria, Egypt, and Sudan. And then the latter, mostly due to the activities of the Wagner Group and the anti-terrorism, quote unquote, I put it in quotes, because Russia's less interested in killing terrorists than it is in chasing Western forces out of Africa. But again, the Sahel is where a lot of the Wagner Group's anti-terrorism activities are taking place.
You know, Bob, you mentioned the reaction of the South Africans and how they were pretty blunt with you about instrumentalizing the relationships they have with China and with Russia to pursue their own ends, right? And I think we saw plenty of examples of this in the Cold War, where African countries would play off the U.S. versus the Soviet Union to get the better deal. Did you see examples of that, or did your research uncover instances of that elsewhere across the continent? In other words, how much are these countries playing Russia off versus China to get a better deal, so to speak?
The person who specifically brought that up was in South Africa. Now, in other places, I got more of the U.S. versus China in Africa, and how our fixation, the U.S. fixation on China in Africa, actually gives these smaller African countries more leverage than they would otherwise have. And in fact, one guy said to me, look, he said, I see the U.S. and China as having more compatible interests in Africa than Russia and China do, in terms of you both are after economic development, trade, and things like that. He said, you'll hear people call Russia the sheriff in Central Asia and China, the banker, right? That sheriff banker sort of model has been used for Central Asia. And he applied it to Africa. He said, look, the Russians are sheriffs here, not because they want to be. They're sheriffs here because it's the only role available to them. And he said, you and the Chinese actually have more compatible interests here than the Russians and the Chinese do. But, you know, you since you're fixated on competing with each other, it gives us leverage and agency we would not otherwise have.
What are the implications of what you've uncovered for the United States? Is there room for us to try to exploit any fissures between these two strategic competitors to position ourselves as the more attractive international partner in diplomatic, economic, and relative terms? What's the so what for Washington?
Yeah, so in terms of intentionally trying to drive a wedge between China and Russia, which you'll hear Americans say, policymakers sometimes say that, it's really the worst idea I can possibly think of, right? As soon as we insert ourselves into the equation, we bind them together, we don't drive them apart. I think our best bet in Africa, as in some other regions, is to focus on common interests. And again, I go back to what the scholar I was talking to, I think in Kenya told me, and that was you and China actually have more compatible interests than the Russians and the Chinese do. So focus on economic development, focus on trade. In terms of overt cooperation with China and Africa, that's never going to happen, but I don't think. As an aside, I'll say I'm a Russia guy, so I'm always sensitive to the fact that I could be naive on China. I don't think I'm naive on Russia. I think I understand exactly what the Russians are about and what they want, but I'm always sensitive to the idea that I might be missing some malevolence in Chinese policy, you know, that's there, but my research hasn't uncovered it. But that being said, and that being a possibility, I would still say, our best bet is to focus on common interests. We have many more of those in Africa with China than we do with Russia. Not try overtly to drive a wedge between them, because we just become the binding agent and bind them closer together whenever we present ourselves into the equation. So it's really just a very sort of interest-based, sober interest-based kind of unemotional assessment of the situation that I think we should follow.
Well, Bob, it's a fascinating topic, really an excellent article. I commended to our listeners. You can find it at fpri.org. It's based on some really excellent field work. And Bob, we'll look forward to having you back to talk about the next chapter, the Central Asia chapter of this larger book project you're working on. So Dr. Bob Hamilton, research professor of Eurasian Studies at SSI, thanks for joining me today.
It was great to be with you, John. Thanks for the invitation.
You can now find SSI Live on TuneIn Radio and on popular podcast directories like Stitcher and at the iTunes Store. If you have any comments on our podcasts, thoughts on what you'd like to see addressed, or a response to something you heard here at SSI Live, please go to our website. That's ssi.armywarcollege.edu. Find me, John Denny, in the staff directory, and send me an email. I look forward to hearing from you. For the SSI Live podcast series, I'm John Denny. Thanks for listening.